This episode is brought to you by 6 Feet Up, the Python, Django, and AI experts who solve hard software problems. Whether it's scaling an application, deriving insights from data, or getting results from AI, 6 Feet Up helps you move forward faster. See what's possible at 6feetup.com.
Hi, welcome to another episode of Django Chat, a podcast on the Django Web Framework. I'm Carlton Gibson, joined as ever by Will Vincent. Hello, Will.
Hey, Carlton.
Hello, Will. And today we've got with us Farhan Ali Raza, who I had the pleasure with of spending this summer working on the Google Summer Code project to bring template partials into Django Core. Hi, Farhan. Thank you for coming on the show.
It's an honor to come here. I have been seeing you for months, and I have been following Carlton for years. So it's an honor to be here.
Oh, I'm all blushing now. So come on, Farhan, let's talk about template partials and the Google Summer Code project, because that was the big thing. And I've mentioned it a few times on the show, but you were on the sort of coalface doing the hard work there. So how was that for you? Describe the summer.
It was amazing. I did not think that it will be that hard, but when I was applying I was just thinking it's just a package, I'm just gonna copy paste things. So but when I find out it was not just copy pasting. So it was amazing experience. I learned a lot of things. It was great.
Well, and I'll just mention, you've written about this on your blog, so we're going to put links to everything, but you went into more depth. But that's pretty impressive that your first Google Summer of Code is like a top 3 feature in a major release, I would say. Carlton, what about for you? You've mentored other people.
I was just going to ask Farhan, was there a moment when you panicked? Was there any moment where you were like, oh no, this is going wrong?
Panic? I will not call that panic, but first moment when I realized this is not what I thought it will be, was when I was handling I think it was the first PR in Django packages or Django template partials, when we were handling render time and compile time things. So I did not even think about that when applying. So I was thinking this is something else. There is a kind of thought that kind of you have to think before making changes and stuff like that. So that was the whole process was cool. I enjoyed the whole process. There was no panic per se, but it was just a surprise there.
Okay. I mean, so the way I've described it when we talked about it on the show is that without your help, I would never have been able to get it in. Not because I couldn't physically do it, but I just didn't have the time. I didn't have the capacity. It really does need somebody dedicate, a 12-week project does need someone to dedicate a good chunk of time to actually make it happen. Because there's a lot of things which were, the third-party package was okay, but not up to Django standards.
Yep. And there are so many side quests that happen when we are merging something into Django. The thing that I remember is we merged that thing to find partials, the regex solution that was merged into Django template partials, and then that was merged. So we thought the regex was the solution, and there was 5 or 6 reviews for that regex. We have to fix the regex part, and in the next PR we remove that regex. So there are many side quests that happen.
Well, anytime you bring in a regex, you're in trouble, right?
Yeah.
So okay, look, we'll move along there. But tell us a bit more about yourself. Were you a student? What are you up to now?
I have graduated in 2023, Bachelor's of Computer Science. I Now I'm like just freelancing and stuff, like working part-time like that. Before that, I was a pre-med student. So I was not like a computer science student, but like it like there is, I don't want to go that deep into it, but like there is a process in like Pakistan called MCAT. So there is a like a competitive exam for medical admissions, like MBBS student admissions. So that was the goal when I was doing pre-med. But I discovered kind of programming in my like 11th grade. So there is like it's different. I don't know like what is in Spain or America, but like it's first 11th grade, 12th grade, and after that you start your bachelor's degree. Okay. So I discovered programming in like 11th grade. I was just I downloaded a book, Head First, like HTML, CSS.
Yeah.
That then I discovered HTML, CSS, and like I thought that was very interesting. So it was lucky, like I could not clear the competitive like exam, and but I could become like a doctor of pharmacy or something like that. So I thought I don't want to do medical at all. I want to do computer science. So I switched the whole thing around.
Okay, that all seems to be coming out quite nicely for you now.
Yeah.
How is it taught in Pakistan? Do you use Python? Is it Java? Or what is the formal, or what are the languages that are used?
It depends on the university. Like every university have a different way of teaching. Like most commonly, I think they start with C++. Like in first semester, there is introduction to programming. That is C++. And after that, Python comes at like, I think, fourth or fifth semester. After that, like Python and stuff.
And do they have anything on web development per se? Because in the US, they don't. It's like an elective course usually.
I think in Pakistan that is also an elective course, but they have made it like it is not elective, like you will have to take it. So because they in like smaller universities, they don't have like a lot of teachers, so they just enforce even elective subjects. So there is a one development or web development course.
And but, is that, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, but they don't teach anything productive there. So I remember like we did HTML and CSS in 2021, I think. Like HTML and CSS just in 6 months or so that semester.
Right. That's not, that's the case also in some US universities. So it really depends. Sometimes the web development course is designed for people who are not computer science majors. Actually, often it's not. So that's why it'll be HTML, CSS, a little bit of JavaScript, but there's not that many places that have a, you know, Django course or a Spring Java course. For some reason, it seems important, right? Because everyone gets trained and then goes to work on the web. But I guess there's a databases course, but there's even MIT, just down the street from me, they have a missing semester. It's like a January term where they teach like how to use Terminal, how to use GitHub, how to do web development, because in the core MIT curriculum, you're not going to take web development unless you do it on your own, right? So it's everywhere.
There is a very good course that Harvard gives, like that is called CS50. Like I learned my Python from that course.
Oh, wow. Did you actually, this is the David Malan course, did you work through the whole thing? Because like famously people start, but then it's a lot of work to do on your own and it just sort of keeps ramping up the demands.
I knew programming, like some programming before that. So I just like watched the stuff that I wanted to learn. There was, I think, a Django video for 1 hour. And like the Python video, there is for 1 hour. So I just saw like what I wanted to learn from that. I did not like follow the whole course. I just like learned the small parts that I wanted to learn from that. But that was very like a very good course.
I want to ask you about all the things you've been doing since the Summer of Code project, because you've been quite prolific. I've got a whole bullet point list of projects to mention, but can you talk us through your open source work around Django for the last few months?
Can I just hype you up a little bit? I would say, besides the fact Carlton knows you, when I look and see who's doing really interesting stuff, it's like you again and again and again and again. So it's not just with Carlton. I'm having discussions with people. We're sitting back going, who is this mad scientist doing all these crazy things? So it's just so you know, it's really exciting to see someone smart with new ideas just doing stuff because. So it's exciting for the community that you're doing this.
I started Django Bolt because I did not want to use like Fast API. So... because there was a like side project I was building that required WebSockets or like a server like SSE server sentiments. So when I went to like the forum, it said like you will have to use like Daphne for because like some like long views take time, so you will have to do that or use channels, Django channels. So there was a fear of Fast API and Django channels, so I thought I should build a new framework to solve that. So I built
go on, carry on.
For some reason, I just wanted to have something fast because I really enjoyed ORM part of Django. Like, it is amazing. So, I just wanted to have something fast that is built for Django. So, and then I saw Robin. There is a framework called Robin. It is also like Rust and Python mixture. So, I thought like, it should be possible to like build something that handles request in Rust and does like business logic in Django part of the things. So that gives me like inspiration to like go all in. I started that just as an experiment. So I wanted to see if like that was possible or not. But when I like tried to implement it, its performance was very good. So I thought like I can spend like months after that to like make it something better.
Okay, and you've mentioned the phrase performance was very good. It's one of my pet peeves that on the show that people talk about fast, but they never give any numbers. And you've been laying down benchmarks from day one, which is what makes it so exciting. So can you give us some idea of the performance, the throughput you're seeing on Django Bolt?
So I agree with you, like performance is subjective, like it will all depend what you are doing in views. There is like a whole Reddit discussion when I launched Django Vault on that. So everybody was saying these benchmarks are like just wrong, like this does not prove anything and stuff like that. So like my whole point was like when I am building something, I will have to use something to measure something, like what I will do, like a build a whole application and deploy it on a VPS to measure. I cannot do that. I will have to measure like small JSON, small database queries, small like stuff, so that I know like if I make a change, it makes a positive impact on my like base results. So what I am getting in, like, if we use one worker, so one worker in Django Bolt is one Actis thread. Like, Actis is a Rust framework that I use, and that one Actis thread is bound with one like Python event loop. So yes. Actis handles the Rust part, and Python event loop like execute the whole Python thing. So that makes one worker. So that one worker, I get about 27,000 RPS on like simple, if we return a simple hello world JSON. So if we do like a database query, so that like the ORM becomes kind of the bottleneck for that. So that like the performance that becomes, that is still faster if we use SQL Alchemy with SQLite. So yeah. I have not measured with PostgreSQL or like faster ORMs with fast API, but I have measured with like SQL Alchemy. So that I was getting about 5,000, nearly I think 5,000 RPS with like, I think there is one query for 10 records that reads.
Okay, and what's kind of difference between that and the vanilla Django, I guess, would be the question.
The performance difference.
Yeah.
If like we like take account like database queries, if we compare database queries, then the performance difference is like, I think 1000 RPS on Django. Like if we use some faster serialization and like I have forgotten the actual numbers, but like I think it was 1000 RPS on Django, like raw Django, and like I think I got about like 4,000, I think 5,000 RPS in Django Bolt.
So both of those sound quite fast, right? I mean, the first thing I saw here was you did a project called Django Rapid, which was using which was just Python based vanilla Django, but then changing out the serializer layer, and were comparing REST framework serializers to Pydantic serializers to MessageSpec serializers. And what was interesting, I thought, there was that you were getting fast API like throughputs just with. Basically with Django.
Yep. If like we compare like database queries, like the performance is kind of equal. It like I think it will like if we have, because Django ORM or fast API ORMs are async, so if we have a lot of queries and like a lot of business logic, then the performance, I think the performance difference will increase, I think. And but like if we compare simple read queries, the performance difference is nearly equal, like difference is not very stark.
And what I think is lovely about all these benchmarks is you've got them all up on GitHub, and everyone can go and look at them, and everyone can pull them locally, and everyone can run them themselves, and they can see that these ideas are, well, actually, you know, Django slow is, well, no, it's not. It's the same speed as everything else. It just depends what you're doing.
Yeah.
You mentioned async ORM then. Today, I think, or yesterday, you put out a kind of turbo ORM package, which is an async query manager for the Django ORM, right? Talk us about that.
So the idea was, I think Adam Gill, he created like a benchmark of like time. He was comparing the whole like the request response like time cycle. So he wanted to measure that with like the async backend that Frey created. So he also like, I think he does not said like another, I forgot his name. He said like you should be able to use that async backend with Django Bolt and measure like what performance difference you get. So when I tried to use it, because it is just a async backend, so we can just use raw SQL. So I thought like it will not be that hard, just because in my mind I was thinking I'm gonna overload some like execution of Django queries and like use that async backend and just create it. But like when I tried to create it, like that was a whole another process. It took me like 4-5 hours of work to just like create some thing working, because it worked like in one request it worked fine, like it loaded the thing. But when I wanted to benchmark it with the Bombardier, the like I was getting like connection exhaustion errors, so I had to fix polling issues and stuff like that. And I did not know like the full it's a naivety of like a person. So I did not know how the full ORM and database things works, I did not even think about like how the connection management works and how the stuff like that things work. So in my naivety I started, and after that I have to solve the whole connection things and stuff like that, because Django handled the sync version of Django handles the connection in a very different way. It like I think Threads context was and stuff like that. So it like I think it when you do not use polling, it closes after request. I don't know if that the case, but I could not find anything for async that like we were discussing before this podcast.
Yeah.
So I will try the async signal thing on that.
What I love is the way you just, like not just, but the way you dive in, you're like, yeah, I'm going to take this on, I'm going to do it. And then you discover the massive blocker and you're like, right, I'm going to fix that as well. And you just keep going. So, I mean, for me, looking through the front Rust front end for the request response plan, I think that's a really exciting development. Looking at the different serializers, we talked about that on the show before, but like REST framework serializers are kind of last generation, and there's Katas, there's Pydantic, there's MessageSpot, there's all these much quicker options out there. And to demonstrate those with Django is like a real service to the community. It's like, yes, look, this is how you do it, and look how much faster they are. Wow. And then for me, the async, properly fully asyncifying the ORM is like the last piece of the async story. You know, if we go all the way down to the database connector, then, you know, whatever you want to do with async, whether you want to use it or not, it's the story's then at that point finished. So like you're really hitting kind of all the tick boxes of the things I'd love to see.
This portion of Django Chat is brought to you by 6 Feet Up. What's stopping you? Maybe it's an application that won't scale or an AI initiative that just isn't delivering. That's where 6 Feet Up comes in. With deep expertise in Python, Django, and AI, they solve hard software problems, modernize platforms, and get teams to market faster. Their impact speaks for itself. Automating healthcare pipelines for hospitals, helping NASA explore Pluto, building severe weather prediction tools, and applying AI to connect farmers with vital crop data. When the stakes are high and the problems are hard, 6 Feet Up is the partner that delivers. See what's possible at 6 Feet Up, the partner that delivers.
I think it's, I'm like just, like, I understand that part. Like, as a beginner, you kind of like obsess over benchmarks for some reason. Like, that thing is fast, that thing is fast, that thing is fast. So, as a beginner, I kind of like that my thing is fast kind of stuff. So, that was the whole kind of process. If we have ORM that is full async, that will make the ORM very fast, because there is like a sync to async part and the whole stuff. I was trying to handle sync in Django Bolt, the performance drop for sync to async part like becomes very like stark at that. If you are getting like some, even if you don't use the ORM, the performance difference, if you are getting 22,000 RPS and you want to execute the synchronous views, you like create a wrapper using sync to async. Yeah. So on the above, the performance difference drops like 22 to direct like 10,000-12,000. So there is like a 50% drop there because of the thread part of the whole thing. So if we have the whole ORM async, I think that will be the performance difference will become, I think, a stark, like a 50% or something like that. So
are you hitting the gill there, just out of interest? Is that where the, because obviously there's a cost to spin up the extra thread, but is it the fact that the Python threads aren't able to execute in parallel? that's causing a lot of the blockage there? Do you know? I mean, you may not know. You may not have been able to profile that.
Because like how the Django Bolt works, there is one gil for one worker. So Actis is the one worker and then the gil part. So if we have something that execute using thread, it kind of blocks a gil for some reason. So this is also a gil part and also a latency part of like spinning up a new thread for handling that request, I think.
But do you think, well, I mean, have you experimented with the, I can never say this because of the F and then the TH, the free threading mode on Python 3.14?
No, its performance decreases very much. Like it's for some reason, I think it is not kind of ready or something. The performance difference like decreases. It like decreases a lot, like not like normal decrease. It decreases a lot. Okay. I tried it with like I think Fast API AV and Django Bolt. The performance difference decreases a lot. I think there is some issues or like I was not able to. And also because the Pyo 3, it does not like it has different. Like for it has a different method of handling the non-threading Python. So I was not using the whole things that it provides to handle like non-threading Python. So I think that also causes an issue. So I was not able to like properly benchmark that.
Okay, that's not quite ready yet. Okay, that's, I think all that's really interesting. Will, jump in before we disappear down the...
I'm happy to listen. You have so many projects. I wanted to ask about the bulk mail verifier, which seems like was one of your early projects, but gets a lot of usage. What can you say about that project?
So that was the project, I have been, because I had to work part-time when I was like studying. So that is a project that I have been working when I was studying. That project is like a partnership with like another person. He's like, I build stuff and like he manages the whole selling part of the stuff. So it's an email validation site, like for email marketing. People come in and validate their email, like this is a valid email, this is a invalid email, this is a catch-all email, and that like people take that result and do email marketing with that.
So did he come to you with that idea, or is that like how it seems like that would be the case, right? As a student, I mean, I wouldn't think of that unless I was in the email marketing world.
He's an email marketing kind of guy. So he knew that it was his idea and stuff. So I was just the like kind of CTO part of it. So I was going to build and like we have like a partnership kind of thing there. So
yeah,
that we...
That's not a bad setup. That's Carlton's setup right now at his startup.
Yeah, no, I do exactly that. Like, I'm the code monkey and he's the thing. Yeah.
Okay. I guess the one other one, we're not quite at 30 minutes, but I want to ask, Carlton has mentioned that, do you use LLMs and AI in your coding at all?
I use a lot of it.
Can you tell us about it? Because I feel like a dinosaur, we use them, but I use them to sort of tack on to my existing learning profile. But it seems like you're just sort of straight lining LLMs and doing it in a better way than I do. So what's your process? How do you think about them?
I am kind of lazy. I enjoyed coding because like it's a puzzle. Like I like solving puzzles, kind of that. So, but typing was never my thing. When like I started, there was no LLM, but I did not enjoy typing the code. So LLM part solves that part for me. So I use Claude Code. So it depends on like what I am trying to do. I usually start with plan mode because it is so hard to predict what they are gonna do. So I usually start with plan mode for Claude code. Like if I am, for example, like if we discuss like Django Turbo. So what I will do with that is I will start with plan mode. It does not produce any code with that plan mode. It just produces a markdown file. So I will go, I will discuss the whole plan with it. So if I wanted to build like an async ORM, so I will discuss like, because I did not know. So I tell him like, this is the repository, the Django backend, and this is what I want to build. It like researches the whole thing, and I usually have like a cloned Django repository in the project folder. So I say this is the Django repository, like tell me like how can I achieve that thing. So it like goes all in, and like at the end it produces a plan like what we want to achieve. I read that, and if like that makes sense, or if I want to change something, because like once you enter, like if you accept the plan and you want to change something, they forget that like they have added a function or class, and they are gonna just like create a new thing. So you will have a lot of code that has no like purpose in there. So that is kind of an annoying part. So I usually spend a lot of time planning and stuff. I research if like I'm not sure if like the LLM is telling something. So I will go and like read my code myself and like tell it like you are thinking it is wrong, or you're like your hypothesis is wrong. Yeah, stuff like that. So that is kind of the whole process. So after that, like testing is a whole another thing with LLMs. I think it is impossible to produce like correct test with LLMs, because they think like, and you are like, they don't think like we humans do. So like their tests are like made up things. They are gonna test what, like they are gonna say it is working, but I can see it is not working. So the testing part is a whole another thing. I usually like tell it to like test, but if you remove that git commit, the test should fail. So that I followed from Django. So I forgot her name. Natalia. Yeah, he said like if you create a test, the test should fail without the fix. So I took that thing from that. So I like tell LLM to like test should fail, but it still produces a lot of bogus tests. So that is a very,
it removes the kit, the commit, and then puts an assert false in the test and goes, look, the test failed.
I think that is like, it is a problem with reinforcement learning. They too optimize for passing off the test. Whenever I will say like create a failing test for this case, it will create a test that is passing, but in the test it will have a if condition, like it is failing but it will pass the test for some reason. So they are very afraid of like failing tests. So I think they are OCD kind of personality they have. They don't want to have a failing test at all.
That's really interesting. I mean, there's, I think that's the way to do it. I know you're a better user of them than I am, but you have to plan with them in advance. And I mean, so one of my colleagues, Paul Everett, he's been doing a bunch on spec-driven development. And so basically what you described, like talking through, planning things out. And I suppose you're too young to know, but the joke is you could never get a human, like a senior software architect, to write specs for something. But now that the LLM will do it for you, everyone suddenly is excited about specs, whereas they never were excited about specs before. So it's forcing maybe good behavior on humans. So there's an irony in there for those of us who are a little bit older. But I completely agree. I wonder if there's, if we're going to have different, because they're so eager to write code, so eager to pass things. I don't know if it's a filter or it's a different retraining, but it feels like they do need to be harsher, at least in a coding context, right? It would, I wonder, you know, yeah, can the companies get there? Can we get there with better prompts? Can some third-party package come in with a whole thing of like, you know, how do we get there? Because I agree, it's a big problem, especially around tests.
Because in plan mode, they don't start to write code. And I tweeted like few weeks ago at Claude, like it, for some reason, it is like very eager to write code. Like it is very eager to produce a hypothesis, even if like it is a wrong hypothesis. Like it is very eager to say, oh, I found it. But in whole conversation, like it will be say 2 and 3 times, I found it, but it never found it. Like it just say I found it, but like it will create a like wrong hypothesis and like start working on it. And after that it will, oh, I did this thing wrong. But it will forgot to revert the changes that it made because of that wrong hypothesis. So there is a lot of code that is like just unowned code. So that is just a junk that kind of lives there.
I'll just say one last thing, Carlton, and then you take it. I know from at JetBrains and our AI team's work, a lot of times the benchmark is user accepted completion rate. So they want you to say, oh, that looks good, and move on. And so I suspect that writing more code or writing things that pass, even though it's not good, is better than them. Like they're not incentivized to say, don't do that, right? I think, you know, that sounds simple, but I really do think it's almost like I can see, like we say, oh, what's our, you know, completion rate, user acceptance rate, whatever, for Juni versus Claude Code versus Copilot. Like that's the benchmark that internal AI teams are using, which would lead to that behavior.
I think that is why it is gonna always try to pass the test. Like even if that feature is not complete or not working, it is just gonna pass the test if it's working. Hey, like congratulations.
But you should be able to put like a 10x multiplier on removing code, right? Like if you get a point for adding code, you should get 2 points for removing code, right? I want that.
There is
that
new
agent
skill that Claude Code creator introduced, simply code simplify. I have not tried it like very significantly, but it is kind of does that. Like it is gonna see the commit that you made for the solution. It is gonna go over all the changes that it is gonna simplify the code and like try to remove if like it thinks it does not belong. I think that is a step in the right direction. I think the difference that I find in a human code and an LLM code, it's also like a viral tweet. The human code is beautiful. Like everything that it produces, it looks like it is like it was designed to do that thing. The LLM code is like a kid coding. It is just gonna solve the thing. Like it is not gonna see like if I'm putting that functions there, why I'm putting there, like it should belong to that file or not. A lot of comments that it adds. So like beautification of like beautiful code, like if you think like a coding as an art, like that is human. And if you think like LLM coding, that is like a kid coding. Like it is going to solve the task. It is going to solve the issue, but like the code will be everywhere and like stuff like that. The difference we can see if like we see a professional code base like Django and a solution provided by an LLM. So the difference is very clear there.
Sorry, I have one more question. That code simplifying thing from Claude, I know, I think it was only 4 or 5 days ago that came out, but that's really interesting. So my question is, how do you stay informed about all this? I mean, because Carlton and I, like, we pass tips on like RSS feed readers because we love to see like blog posts. And I feel like we're multiple generations back. Like, are you on, so like, what are your news sources to stay up to date on
all
this?
I think you also have that Simon Wilson newsletter. that is a very good source. And like on, I think Twitter, part of social media, is very eager for vibe coding. Mastodon is like 180 degrees of that. They don't want like AI in their code. So
that's where Carlton and I hang out with our Django, you know, graybeards.
Django graybeard AI haters.
The creator of Flask, I forget his name. He also did a like poll. The Mastodon people and the Twitter people, the poll is like a 180 degree. Like Twitter, there is like less than 10% of code, like LLM write, and in Mastodon, like there is like, I think larger than 50% code I write myself. So there is a difference. There is like the extreme kind of like two things. I kind of believe that like both, like any extreme, I don't know the word for that. Like any extreme, what is the word like that? Like any extreme thought a person have, like any extreme opinion, sorry. And any extreme opinion a person have, like extreme opinions are never right. So the truth will always be like something in like in between. So if like coding changes, it will be like kind of 50% human, 50% LLMs and stuff like that.
I guess my question here is, it probably loops back to what you've already said, but I think these machines are very good at creating stock code, you know, boilerplate that you've, you know, seen written 100 times. It seems to me they're less good when you're trying to push the boundaries into something that's not directly in the training data, that's new, right? And you seem to be doing a lot of things that are new. So how do you find? I mean, is it the planning mode? Spending enough time in the planning mode helps to pin it down.
It's like trying different things. I ask for like if something is not working, I ask for like options. Like give me options to solve this thing. So it is gonna say like it is gonna be an extreme option there. It is gonna be like something that I think like can work. So I will say try that. That is also, I think, a very good point for LLM, because we can try a lot of options, because the price of code is very cheap that way. So if like that thing does not work, I can just like discard those whole changes. So I try different options. There is like two extreme. One time you are gonna say like LLM is, oh, LLM, this solution was very intelligent, and sometime it is gonna be stupider than a dog. The solution is very like stupid. It thought something else and produced something else. So there is like extreme cases there. So I think we can never like predict LLM stuff. That makes them dangerous, kind of that way. So there will always be human for coding, I think. There will be less human, but there will always be human somewhere.
Well, it's so interesting to think about how your brain is being wired, because for me, like I had to type everything, and you're making me almost rethink the advice I would give people, which is before you start coding, make sure you're a really good typist, because you don't want any friction between typing and thinking. But so for me, like if I don't type something, this is my biggest problem with LLMs. If I don't type it, I'm missing a pathway in my brain. So I'll have LLM code. And part of it is I didn't fully think it through, but I think a lot of it is I just didn't type it. And so you're making me wonder, maybe that's just a step leap that the newer generation of people, you know, won't have that problem. Like they'll just be like, oh, this is normal. This is how I do things. Because I don't know, Carlton, is that the case for you? For me, if I don't physically type it, it doesn't quite get in there. But that's because that's how I learned how to code originally.
There's something in that. Yeah, go on, Farhan, you were going to speak. So you
think that is kind of right, because if LLM produces a code, like the solution works, but I don't fully understand it 100%. Like I don't understand it fully. So the difference kind of becomes, you have to be a good reader of the code. If you like read it and you will have to, because sometimes like, because I was new to Rust. So sometimes it produces like keywords or something like that that I don't understand. So there is like a skill to have, like you should have a kind of a way to, like, you want to learn. So if it uses RWLoc, you don't know RWLoc, you should ask it to, like, what is RWLoc. If you just become a, like, just enter like everything except, like, it just works and stuff like that, so that you will not never, like, understand, like, what it is doing. There is a thing, like, if you code it yourself, you understand it better. When I was working for JSOC, I was very aware of that thing. So I usually, if I used LLM, I used it for like small commits. There is a mode in Cloud Code where you, like, you don't accept changes, it just shows you that commit. So if like I see that commit, I will say, like, this is not Django standard, so rewrite it this way. Or, like, if I wanted to do it myself, I'm gonna rewrite it that way. So if you want to understand the code, it is a requirement that you will have to read it, and if you type it, then, like, you will be a better understander than just a simple person that uses LLM to just push everything.
I'm really interested here where the equilibrium point ends up falling, in that I'm 100% convinced that, you know, the person who just taps yes and accepts, you know, accepts, they're going to be in trouble. They might be able to produce something very quickly, but, you know, code is more maintenance than it is production. And then at the other end, I'm as much as it might pain me just to think, I don't think we can handcraft every character anymore, because of the economics of it aren't going to make any sense. And so, between those two extremes, that it's got to settle somewhere, and maybe there are a range of sustainable positions that an individual developer could take up. But I mean, how are you finding in your freelance work that you have to balance these things?
Freelance work is very repetitive. So if, like, a person comes, most of the people come with a, like, kind of an MVP of the project. So I want auth, right. I want like stuff like that is already there, like solved kind of things. So LLM is very good at those. Like, if you tell it to do auth in Django, it will, like, does it, like, 100% correctly kind of. So in freelance work, if, like, problem is something interesting or something complicated, that kind of, like, a recent project that I am doing, it is a, like, software for ships. Like, there is like a task is assigned to people on ships, like ocean ships kind of that. So it does not get it. Like, it does not understand it. Like, if a task is, like, the whole thing is that it does not understand world. Like, AI companies say it does, like, it does not. So if, like, it creates a task, it, like, makes wrong hypothesis about the real world. Stuff like that. So that way you have to guide it. Like, you, like, if a delivery comes, a person have to accept that delivery. It is gonna put all the buttons on the top to accept delivery, accept. I saw that because I built that. It, like, if a delivery comes, I have to see the product and, like, receive that delivery, because that's how the real world works. But it created, like, every button on the top to accept delivery, and it asked nothing, like what is the delivery ID, what is the, like, there is a whole process, there is a difference, the whole, like, how the real world works and how LLM thinks it works. Because I think that this is the whole context problem also, because if it is working on a small solution, it kind of forgets a lot of how the other things work or something like that. So it has a narrow focus kind of that way. So there is a difference. If a problem is kind of real, like, so I will have to, like, like explicitly say that like you don't want to do that, you have to do this like in this way. So that's the kind of the difference.
I mean, I wonder if it's a training data problem too, because there's a lot of authentication examples, like how many real world Django shipping container options are there? Like, is there a point where it, and actually that's, I'm going to pose you my philosophical questions to get your take. Are you familiar with the term model collapse? Have you seen this idea out there? I can describe it. It's basically that as the data goes from being human generated to being computer synthetic generated, there was an academic paper out of Oxford 2024 showing that over time, if you train on synthetic data, the LLMs get worse, right? So in my mind, I think of it as we know the underlying data is kind of getting worse. Like it's AI stuff, even as the models are somehow getting better. So, but where does that all end up? It feels to me like maybe the whole foundation is crumbling beneath us. But I'm curious what your take is on that. I feel like you're much more in tune with these tools.
I watched your video that you made about
it. Oh, okay.
I just don't remember the keyword. So
yeah.
I agree 100%. It is also becoming a race for the benchmarks that they have set up. Like it is like they want to optimize for those benchmarks. So if like you compare a GPT 5 point something to Claude Code, even if like Claude Code is better, but like GPT is gonna be like higher on the benchmark or something like that. And the data problem is real. Like that is also, I think that data problem and the architecture problem, because like you can say it is AGI, but it is just a probabilistic like prediction of the next word. You can say it is more intelligent, but it will never be. It is just a prediction of the next word. But like the like people who are like more intelligent than me, but like they are gonna say like your brain also predict the next word, but it does not. Like we cannot explain it, like what our brain does, but it does not predict the next word. Because if I walk on a like an icy road or something, I know I'm gonna fall because I have like fallen when I was 4 or something. So the context of that 20 years is there with me. So LLM, I agree with that, your statement, like 100% the artificial data part and like the optimizing for the benchmark part, like it is never going to be like more intelligent than, this is my opinion. It is not going to be more intelligent than human in like general tasks. You can train it for a specific task in specific environment and specific like in a box. It is going to be more intelligent than a human. But if you break that box and everything is going to fall, like stuff like that.
Carlton, you look like something.
I'm just nodding away. You talked about lack of ideas of causation, lack of decent proper memory, lack of world models. These are just the criticisms. And the LLM architecture has gone a long way, and they are truly amazing what they can do. But you know, if nothing substantive changes, then it looks okay. That's a very clever trick and it's a very useful trick, but it's not AGI, as you know, was promised to us by now by Lord Orwell.
Well, let's dodge the AGI bullet. I think you're right what you were saying though about the benchmarks. I mean, this is something that JetBrains, again, I'm just going to read it out. They have a developer productivity AI arena, DPAI. So they're trying to do an open standard, because right now there are these kind of closed standards for the major models. And it just leads to, you know, optimizing for the standard, right? When it's like, well, who set the standard? What is the standard, right? So I think there is some work being done there to have something better that hopefully makes the models better. But it's like, as complex and intelligent as these things are, it's sort of like, we all have narrow incentives as humans and as AIs. So,
I guess to bring it back to Coda, you know, I'm you know, veteran. I use these tools. I think, okay, they're interesting, you know, but I don't feel that my career is under threat. You're sort of at the other end of your career. How do you feel about them?
I kind of think, like, there is a fear. Like, I'm not going to lie. Like, there is a fear of, because in the world kind of like that we live in, corporates are going to optimize for the cost. That is like stuff like that. So if I am like, if I am trying to get a job in a small city, like where I live, but I like, there is a fear. Like, in short, there is a fear, like, the whole thing is going to change and like, there will be less jobs. But the thing that is, like, I am hopeful, like, because, like, I like to learn and, like, to know stuff. So, only those people who kind of have that, like, there are some people who are gonna do computer science just for the job. So there is a difference between like a programmer who want to do is for like, because like they love programming, and there is a difference because he, like, someone said it to, like, computer science is a good, like, job or good pay and stuff like that. So I think there will be less programmers, but we don't know because the costs now are very optimized and stuff like that. We don't know how much the LLM actually cost, because, like, not everybody is gonna be able to, like, use them. If, like, something like, not a doomer, but like something, the bubble crash or something like that. So if the cost is gonna be the same or something like that. So there is a fear in, like, normal computer science student, like, there is gonna be no jobs or less jobs.
Well, speaking of jobs, I believe, are you looking for work? Is that fair to say? Or what is your current employment status?
I am looking for work, like full-time work. Now I am just doing freelance stuff. I'm open to freelance contract or job. Anything works for me.
And I will just put a shout out here. Having worked with Farhan over Google Summer of Code and seen him in action since, he is, you know, he's a good find. You should snap him up.
Thank you.
Well, we're going to have links to everything. I guess if somebody does want to get in touch, is, I guess, email on your personal site, LinkedIn. What is the best way for someone to contact you?
LinkedIn is fine. There is also email on the LinkedIn. So, like, both options are fine, LinkedIn or email.
We're basically out of time. I haven't asked you about, you know, static typing and your thoughts and whether in an LLM world everything is pushed that way. But I guess, I don't know. I always like to ask, wait, Carlton, are we doing book reviews?
Oh, I don't know about a book. It's been Christmas holidays. I've hardly read a thing.
Well,
I've got a project I can mention.
Okay, shout
one,
out.
One of our hands that we haven't mentioned, it's Django REPL, which it's sort of full Django environment in the browser, which is an amazing thing. Built on, is it PyScript?
It is TypeScript Svelte on the front end and using WebAssembly, PyDide for the Python part.
PyDide, okay. But that's a super project, so you know, check that out. Okay, so Farhan, I've really, really enjoyed chatting with you and working with you, you know, over the last year. And I'm so excited for all the things you're doing in the Django ecosystem. So thanks for coming on the show.
It's been an honor. Super. Thank you for inviting me.
So DjangoChat.com, we're on YouTube, and we'll see everyone next time. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Thanks again to 6 Feet Up, the Python, Django, and AI experts you call for the hardest software problems. From scaling applications to simplifying data complexity and unlocking AI outcomes, they help you move forward faster. See what's possible at 6feetup.com.